From the American Tobacco Historic District, this is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. How do we treat our children? As parents, the question seems to have a simple answer. The best we can, of course, give them food, shelter, love, inspiration. But with pressures and anxieties in today's troubled economy, do choices made by parents always yield what's best for the child? And with so many recent stories of abuse and underfunded government agencies, we have to ask about our collective will as well. If we examine state and federal budgets, policies on education, child welfare, and poverty, and ask the question again, how do we treat our children? The answer might not be so simple. Joining us in the studio today are three parents from different walks of life. Mike Munger is chair of the political science department at Duke University and the father of two teenage sons. Mike, welcome.
It's great to be on the show.
John McCann is a columnist for the Herald Sun. Father of a two-year-old daughter. John, welcome.
Very glad to be here.
And Beth Posner, an attorney with Legal Aid of North Carolina, as well as a visiting professor at the UNC Law School and a mother to three young children. Beth, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
We're taking your calls as well, 877-962-9862. We doing right by our kids? Are we providing enough for them? Are we giving them too much? Enough emphasis on institutions like education and child welfare? And what pressures are you facing as a parent? What pressures are you facing as a child? And if you're a child listening to this, why aren't you in school? Do you worry about the effects the culture on the outside are having on your kids, and is it too hard to keep those pressures away? Give us a call at 877-962-9862. So let me ask the panel, first of all, if you think, as parents now, that it's harder to be a child today than it was when you grew up. John McCann?
I grew up in, I'm 33 years old, grew up in Southeast Raleigh. I grew up thinking I was middle class. And after getting out and going to college and working a little while, I realized, man, I was actually working class, you know? Mm-hmm. But the thing is that anytime I would hit the light switch at my house, lights would come on, never missed any meals. So I had the sense that, hey, I was just like the Huxtables. Did my parents shower me with a lot of stuff? Not a lot. They gave me what I needed. And I would think in today's society, there's a tendency to want to do even more, more and more and more. I want my child to live a better life than I did. But it's a little bit extreme these days, particularly when it comes to education.
Well, extreme, but is it better? I mean, are we doing better by our kids?
Not better, because more stuff is not the answer.
On that side of the economic scale, we're talking about from say, working class, middle class, upper middle class. So you think things are maybe a little more difficult these days. Mike Munger?
I wonder if maybe it's harder to be a child. I think it's certainly harder to be a parent in the sense that we have more options. And there's more ways to go wrong. My parents were working class also. I was the first person in my family to go to college. And in retrospect, I don't know how they did it. Hmm. The work that they did, the amount of time that they put in. So in some ways, it's much easier for me to be a parent because I have a lot more income, I have a lot more assets, and then I look at the job that they did, and you don't really understand your parents until you yourself have kids. Mm-hmm. I don't think you really fully appreciate them. So I wonder if it isn't harder for us looking back to think, how in the world did they do it?
All right. Well, Beth Posner, but again, focused on the child now, what do you think? Is it harder to be a kid these days?
You know, it's easy to look back on what our childhood was like and have a certain kind of nostalgia because we don't remember, you know, we probably don't remember what was different from us, what was out there that made us question our lives because we were kids. And now we look at our children and we see that there's a lot more expected of them than I think there was of us, and that there are a lot more choices that they have, and there's a lot more media kind of and consumer stuff happening in their lives. But they themselves don't see that, just like we didn't see it growing up. And they themselves don't see the differences around them that we now see and don't see the differences between themselves and their peers. And so they also live in this kind of ideal world, a lot of them. I mean, certainly from our kind of middle class and upper middle class backgrounds, in this ideal world where there isn't any tension between their lives at this point.
Well, this idea of too many options has come up twice now, and I wonder how important a role that plays and how much more difficult it makes it, not only for for parents but for kids who seem to have so many options and are dealing with parents who may not have the experience. Certainly, we didn't have those kind of options. So what kind of experience do we have when it comes time to teach them how to evaluate those, John?
Well, you know, when I'm talking about these options, I'm thinking about, you know, what kind of school should my child go to? You know, there was a time when you just simply sent your kids to school. Now it's, is it a charter school? Is it a private school? Or a private charter school, if there is such a thing. You know, all these options. And, well, if I send them to this particular school, well, that'll get them on this track to do this and that. Man, how about just teach your kid the ABCs, give them the basics. I think we spend too much time, give too much attention to trying to create these perfect kids, almost like athletes. You know, you have these parents who want to create, you know, the prototypical quarterback. And in the end, oftentimes it doesn't work.
Well, I mean, is that true? First of all, do you agree? Let's go around the table again. Do you agree with that, that we're spending a little too much time sculpting our children? And is that a bad thing necessarily, Mike?
I don't think kids have much free time. An awful lot of their attention is focused on homework and outside activities, whereas I certainly had quite a bit of free time to read and try to think about what it was I wanted to do. I also think parents feel like they're responsible for if I make the wrong choice. Mm-hmm. If they're 3, 4, 5 years old, they go to the wrong kindergarten, they're not going to get into Princeton. Mm-hmm. Rather than we'll go to school and we really don't have that much control over kids, but we'd like to think that we do.
It conveys two things, don't you think, Beth, to the child, in addition to perhaps the desire that the best, that they have the best. The other thing it conveys is the anxiety about what if I mess up. The child reads that. And what about the notion that the child is supposed to go to the best schools and be the expectation that I have to live up to something that mom and dad want and be what they want? Is that part of the new pressure?
I mean, I certainly hope that we as parents do a better job of shielding them from that anxiety. That's our anxiety and not their anxiety, and not an anxiety that they should have to live with at that age. But they get that anxiety, you know, not just from parents who are overly involved, but they get that anxiety from end-of-grade tests that they know about pretty early on, and they get that anxiety from having their creativity quenched to kind of perform.
Well, that gets back to this not having enough spare time to just kind of make stuff up.
I mean, there's less and less recess time at schools. I think at one of my children's schools there's 20 minutes of recess.
Mm. Let's talk a little bit. I want to move on to public policy for just a moment because we've taken a look at kind of personal choices, and I want to open up the public policy arena here. We were taking a look at some newspaper articles that we had on the website and that you've read. One was a New York Times article about John G. John's a 15-year-old boy in Greensboro. He was a ward of the state. His mother is missing. His adoptive father dies, and John's adoptive father left him the deed to the home. So that was more than 10 years ago. He's got a home. He's 15 years old. John qualifies for Social Security until he's 18. The state is taking the Social Security payments. For a while, wasn't making payments on the house. He was in danger of losing that for the $200 plus payment that the state wouldn't make. And Child Welfare Agency says, look, we've got to have this money. There's no way we can take care of these children if we don't have their money. Are we not properly funding? Are we taking good enough care of the most vulnerable children among us, John McCann?
I'm not a public policy expert. I don't pretend to be. So let me defer to my colleagues on that one.
Mike Munger?
I'll take a shot. This sounded to me, if you just change a few of the words and the language, it sounds like a Dickens story, where there's some evil landlord that's trying to steal this from the child. In this case, though, it's the state. And we've put state agencies under such pressure that they make choices that look to an outsider as not being logical, but it may be the only one that they have. So it's easy to blame the state for that, but I'm not sure that that's fair. On the other hand, there's a logic of bureaucracy. If you use a bureaucracy to try to accomplish this, this is the way that it's going to work out. I don't know what alternatives we could try, but the foster child system is broken.
Well, John McCann, certainly you can talk to us about that. I mean, the notion that does the state have a responsibility to take care of this child and figure out, you know, the best way to do it? And what they're saying is, we don't have that kind of money. We can't do that unless we take this house or allow the house to go or take his Social Security payments that he's going to need when he gets older.
Now, with that, I'll get on my little soapbox here, because I don't think it takes a public policy expert to explain that, to see that, hey, does the state have a responsibility in these situations? It's kind of a danger zone. It's kind of a slippery slope when you think about, okay, as a parent, if I know that, hey, if I choose to sort of shirk my responsibilities, I know that the good folks from the state will look after my child. And it gets us back to that what's going on here in Durham, where, the mayor has called for, more black men to mentor, okay? I understand that, but at the same time, if I know that, hey, I can just push my kids over to somebody else to have them kind of raise my child, it takes some of the burden, some of the pressure off of me. Now, I don't know if a parent necessarily goes through this thought process, but I think if parents knew that, hey, if I don't raise this child, nobody else will, I think parents need that kind of pressure. And therefore, you wouldn't have, so many wards of the state and that kind of thing.
We're going to examine this more closely as when we come back. We'll take a little break right here. And when we come back, we'll talk more about that, about whether it is true that you can tell about the viability and the credibility of a state based on how well it treats the most vulnerable among them. Does the state have a responsibility? Or, as John McCann suggests, does that, in a sense, rob individuals of the responsibility, the family, of taking responsibility for children? We'll talk more about that. With us is Mike Munger, chair of the Political Science Department at Duke, John McCann, columnist for the Durham Herald Sun, Beth Posner, an attorney with Legal Aid North Carolina, and your phone calls at 877-962-9862. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. We are talking today about how we treat our kids and about how the concept of childhood has changed in the last 50 years. Joining us in the studio are three parents from different walks of life: Mike Munger, chair of the Political Science Department at Duke; John McCann, a columnist for the Durham Herald Sun; and Beth Posner, who is an attorney with Legal Aid North Carolina. We're going to take your phone calls at 877-962-9862. Before the break, we were talking about the story out of Greensboro. A 15-year-old boy, ward of the state, had a house, almost lost it because the state wasn't making payments on the house. They take possession of both the house and Social Security payments. And, of course, as Mike Munger says, a story out of Dickens may be an extreme story, certainly an unusual story. On the other hand, it is a glimpse into the system of child welfare in the state of North Carolina, and I suspect elsewhere. Beth Posner, I know you've had some firsthand experience. So what's your reaction to that story?
Well, my reaction is that while it is unusual, it's not extreme. And just to kind of have a little... just to lay it out there, that this is a legal aid case. I'm not involved with this legal aid case in any way, but this is a legal aid case. And I would say that it's not extreme because, I work with poor families every day, and they feel that pressure that John spoke about. They feel it every day. They don't need any more of that pressure. What they need is to know that there are social resources out there for them to help them pick up the slack that's left there, because they don't have affordable and quality child care. They don't have transportation to get to their minimum wage jobs. They don't live in communities that provide a living wage for them. They don't have the support systems, the basic support systems that we're talking about. These are, very poor families. Over 20% of North Carolina's children live in poverty. And so while this is unusual, it's not extreme. And what concerns me about this case is how typical it is of a social services agency kind of finding a quick fix to their problem. I want to know why they're not funded enough to take care of this child without having to use what little he would have left to lift himself up from this position when he's out of the foster care system. And I want to know who makes that decision to not care for him once he's 18 and is aged out. We have a social services program that's taking care of him now, using his own money to take care of him now, so he won't be able to take care of himself when he gets out. And then, in all likelihood, he could be incarcerated when he gets out. And then we have a whole other social services agency that has to take care of him and deal with him. I want to know when we as a society decide to stop caring for these children. At what age are they not worthy of our support? And when we decide that they're not worthy of that support because they've aged out, they're going to have children who are suddenly going to be worthy of our support. And so, I think that this is a typical quick fix that's short-sighted and, not at all extreme or uncommon.
877-962-9862, the number to call if you want to join our conversation. John McCann.
And to your point, Ms. Posner, isn't that the problem with politics and bureaucracy, in that it always takes a case like John G's until now, you know, let's everybody get excited and get heated up and try to do something about it. You know, not to kind of harp on it, but the Hurricane Katrina situation.
Sure.
Didn't we know about levees years and years ago? What articles written about that kind of situation? But it takes something catastrophic, something extreme, before we want to do something about it. And then the whole bureaucratic political cycle starts all over again.
Except that you can be sure that there are people who've been wanting to do something about it for quite some time, and who, particularly in the current political climate, have been quelched. I mean, legal aid attorneys like the one involved in this case for a long time have been advocating for the poor as loudly, as vocally as they can. And, you know, in the last 10 years have really been silenced in that effort, with cuts in funding, with our hands tied in the kinds of cases we can take. And at the same time that's happening, welfare reform comes along, and the number of real entitlements that poor folks have decreased.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mike Munger, I want to put the question to you another way. If the program, if the systems and institutions worked as well as Beth would like them to work, then wouldn't we be enabling perhaps a deeper systemic problem? We're talking about, initially you said, parents without the transportation networks, without jobs that can help them afford children. They're not making enough money. That seems to me to be talking about an economic system, a political and social structure that needs fixing. And if we took care of Johnny G, would we be blinding ourselves to a deeper problem, Mike Munger?
Well, there's a political imperative to make parents, make people take responsibility for their own lives. And in some ways, that's sort of unthinking and reflexive. And then there's an imperative that we don't make the children suffer. And it seems to me now that we have the worst of both worlds. We have this political imperative where people have to take responsibility, so we have a grudging way of giving them money. They have to fill out a lot of forms. They have to go through all these problems, and we make the children suffer. And it's hugely expensive. And the delivery of services, I think Beth's point was a good one. It's part of a larger problem. Daycare, transportation, lunches, buildings for schools. It's not an isolated problem. It's something larger. It is systemic.
Let's go to the phones. Donna is on the line. Hello, Donna.
Hi there.
You have a question for us or a comment?
Yeah, I do. I'm a psychologist, and I work in a prison. And my concern really was the lack of parenting skills and the lack of services for people. The majority of the people that we see in prison that are incarcerated either have an abusive childhood, a neglectful childhood, or a mental illness. And it seems that since we're not taking care of these issues while the children are young, they become our problem for the rest of their lives.
Beth Posner?
Well, I mean, that is true. I mean, there are just a lack of services. And I, you know, again, I work with families. I do mostly domestic violence work and family law work. And I work with families who are looking for those resources in the community, and they're not there for them. And that is a problem. And they want parenting classes, and we try to find them for them, but they're not there for them.
When you say lack of services, are we saying that there are not any, or people just don't know how to access them?
I think that there are not enough, and people have a hard time accessing them, and particularly people in rural communities and people with transportation problems when there are not public transportation systems, people who don't have childcare to kind of go and take care of the things they need to take care of, and then simply it's not enough.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you're certainly more plugged in to this than I am, but, you know, in the newsroom, you know, you get emails, you get calls about, you know, little forums and little workshops that are going on as far as kids and parenting are concerned. And I assume that these aren't always being conducted by the most professional folks. But at the same time, I'm thinking that there are, you know, programs out there, there are resources. You know, people always talk about, you know, we need more rec centers. I mean, let's look at Durham. We need more rec centers here in Durham. And I say to myself, you know, I don't think that is the answer. I mean, I think we have enough of these things. I just don't think people take advantage of them. Now, that may be because they don't have a ride to get to these places and those sort of things. But, you know, while on the one hand I'm on my soapbox saying, hey, government is government and they're being politicians and bureaucrats, I still got to say, hey, you know, are some of the poor parents doing all that they can do to access these resources?
Well, my answer to that would really be that no, not every parent of any socioeconomic class is doing everything they can do to better their children. But to say that poor people in particular don't take advantage of what's out there would be incorrect. I think that poor parents, just like parents with means to make all of these choices and to be confronted with all of the too many options that we talked about in the beginning of the show, you know, want the best for their children. The same way, you know, we all want the best for our children. They don't have the means, though.
We are talking today about getting the best for our children. Are we doing the most for our children? Mike Munger's with us, chair of the political science department at Duke. John McCann, columnist for the Durham Herald Sun. Beth Posner is an attorney who specializes in domestic abuse cases with Legal Aid North Carolina. And we're taking your calls at 877-962-9862. We're going to Raleigh, where Mike is on the line. Hi, Mike.
How are you doing?
Good.
Me and my wife, we adopted a child about 5 years ago from Missouri. And what Missouri is trying to do now is take away the benefits that my daughter is supposed to receive from Missouri, i.e. Medicaid and the monthly stipend to help my daughter out. My big question is, we spend millions of dollars sending our troops all around the world, and we give money to our countries all over the world. Wouldn't that money be better spent bettering our children's futures?
All right. Thank you, Mike. Question of priorities. What does our budget tell us about how we think about children? John?
Well, you know, it's kind of you pick your poison kind of thing. You know, somebody can argue if we aren't sending our troops all over the world, you know, could that have ramifications on what happens here in our country, and therefore, you know, your kid won't even be safe to go to school. But I do understand the caller's point. You know, I don't even know if money is the question. I mean, we have money to do almost anything that we want to do. It's a question of priorities. And again, I don't think it starts with saying the foster care system is broken. What's broken are our people. You know, it's a people problem. You know, I always ask folks. People call in and say, well, you know, the government is this, and we need to do that. And I always say, well, hey, why don't you run for office? Well, no, I couldn't possibly do that. I think we have the wrong people in office. The people with genuine hearts won't step up and run.
Well, Mike Munger, is that it? And why aren't the people with heart running if that's true?
Well, it may be a little hard on the people with heart. I think that the system is, in a democracy, groups that are organized, that have money, that have resources, are the ones that are served, or the ones that can make a case that sounds exciting. If you're a politician, you want to get reelected. You want to be able to cut the ribbon on bright, shiny objects. So the Donna's call about abuse and neglect and Mike's call about the problem with the adopted child from Missouri both say something that we already know in general, I think, but they're piquant examples of it. In a democracy, those who are least well off are those who are least likely to be well served. And it takes a lot.
And yet they're growing, and forgive me for interrupting, but they are growing in numbers. And the whole idea of democracy is when you have the numbers, you ought to have the votes.
A majority of votes, not a majority of citizens. And people that are poor and disaffected are much less likely to participate in politics.
The U.S. ranks second worldwide in per capita income, and it has the highest percentage of children living in poverty. It's close to 20% now. And John McCann, when you say it's an individual problem, what do individuals do about that when so little of the budget and so many children are in poverty when they're living amidst all of this wealth?
Flesh that out a little bit more for me. You're saying
that in per capita income, the United States is second. That we earn more money than everybody except, I don't know, probably Sweden or something like that. We have the highest percentage of children living in poverty. And I'm talking about developed countries now.
Mm-hmm. You know, again, I think it's an example of people just not taking advantage of what's out there. Now, I know I may come across as a guy who's saying, hey, you know, you've gone to college, you have a degree and all this kind of stuff, you don't understand. But listen, believe me, I'm not, you know, my bank account is not that big, okay? So I'm not that far. I can't miss many paychecks until I'm, you know, find myself right there amidst some of these folks. But, you know, there is help out there, you know, and I think once you get yourself into that system where, you know, you're getting assistance, you get used to that. You get addicted to that. And there's a tendency to kind of sit back and say, hey, man, life's good right now.
Beth Posner, is this a government solution? Should the government be engaged in this, or is government the problem?
I mean, absolutely government should be engaged. I mean, there can't be a question to that. The question is why the government isn't more engaged in a way that's useful, ultimately, that doesn't just provide quick fixes, that you know, that doesn't just require that students all in one school get a certain score on a test, that actually provides for an opportunity for a school system to systemically deal with issues, that doesn't just kind of take a child home, but actually does something for that child. Government is responsible, and government is falling short and has been falling short for quite some time, and we're reaping the benefits or the, you know, we're all the worse for what's going on with our government right now. You know, and Sweden is all the better.
We are, well, one of the government institutions, of course, that affects children most directly is education. Education is a fiscal policy issue. It's a social issue as well. When you get into curricula, we asked you to read an article published in the Winston-Salem Journal about getting bright, motivated teachers to go to underserved areas. Should schools located in different communities be as equal as possible? If they're not, why should the government do anything about it? Is the government doing enough in the area of education? This is a very, you know, it's a local government issue, and it seems this is a place, John McCann, where local citizens can have the most input and most effect, and yet we're hearing day after day problems about schools and about education. What's going on?
You know, programs. You know, this article here was talking about, you know, teachers getting getting board certified. And what strikes me about that is, you know, and again, this is not categorically saying all teachers are like this, but I think to a degree, a teacher has to say, hey, I'm not getting paid that much money. I can go and get board certified, increase my paycheck. Now, in the article right here, it says that when they do this, they aren't all flocking to the poor schools with the poor kids. So it sounds to me like somebody's just trying to fatten their wallet. That's not good.
You end up being a better teacher. It's a national certification, and then the idea is to get those nationally certified teachers into underserved areas. But once you've identified yourself as a little better teacher, your stock goes up, and you don't have to take the hardship pay. Is that something, Mike Munger, that government, you know, should be involved in that level, trying to micromanage these school districts?
Well, I mean, I'm a libertarian, so my view of this is that we need to put choice in the hands of parents, but we can't possibly do that unless we also put money in the hands of these parents. So the Leandro case and other problems that have been pointed out in the North Carolina system, unless the state provides poor counties and poor school systems with enough money to actually be able to provide better schools, I don't think that choice by itself is not going to be enough of a solution. So I think charter schools have been in some ways successful, but I think unless North Carolina has either a voucher program or develops the political will to put more money in the hands of poor school districts across the state, this sort of micromanaging isn't going to have much of an effect. And it's not because they're not trying to do the right thing. They just don't have the resources.
Of course, you know what people say about those voucher programs is you're going to end up with the same problem, is that all the money is going to go to really good schools that'll be private, and the schools that no teacher wants to go to will be the ones that the poorest of the poor with their voucher are going to end up in.
Voucher programs tend to be focused on cities. If the entire state, let's say everybody got $1,500, and if you did this in poor counties, then it would stay in that county. It could go to the public schools there. You're right that a lot of voucher programs are cream skimming.
Let's go to the phones. Viola is on the line from Cary. Hi, Viola.
Hi. I have a concern in that I'm a retired teacher, and I have so many students who would arrive in high school unable to read. And this is both a parental problem and a school district problem. But there's a program that costs about $22,000 that can help these children learn how to read. And, of course, my school is not able to come up with the money for that. So it seems to me that if we really want to solve some of the problems that the children are encountering, we would ask the schools what they need, and somebody would help with grants or whatever to help to get this money, because I will tell you, the last thing we have time to do is write grants when we're doing everything in schools for children.
Thank you, Viola. Beth?
And that's right. I don't know how much more we can ask of our teachers and our principals, who for the most part are incredibly dedicated individuals who've chosen to go into a profession that is not held in the highest of regard these days. I mean, they're among the lowest paid professionals, you know, of that stature. And so we can't be asking them to write grants. Money has to be funneled in, and I think that Mike is right. I mean, the solutions that the Leandro case is looking for are the solutions that we would all hope for, that the big pot of money gets, you know, gets sent out evenly among the poorest counties, and that we really hope that from that we would see a rise in literacy and the other kinds of issues that we're talking about.
The other problems we hear about schools is that teachers are being asked to do too much, that what used to be a job that involved educating a child now has become a social welfare issue, that they're seeing these problems come through the door. They're not equipped, and schools that were designed a century ago really aren't able to handle what they're seeing today. We have to rethink the way we design our schools. Do they have to be different places, John?
Get back to basics. I mean, again, I hope I don't come across as primitive. I mean, I'm certainly not as scholarly as my two panelists here, But what's so hard about how it was when I grew up? You learn your phonics, just basic things. Teach them how to read, teach them how to write, and then just let the kid develop. We complicate the situation. We're trying to add all these programs to things. Just keep it simple.
Well, because people come to the public schools not with the same set of skills, and so they need a lot more. We do have Smart Start and More at Four to a certain extent, but those programs, their funding is getting cut year in and year out, so we don't have universal preschool. We don't have quality child care for everyone, only for those who can really afford it. So by the time folks get to school, they're all at a different place. Mm-hmm. And there needs to be a social community system in the school to help pick up those pieces. We probably need more social workers in the school and school psychologists than we have. But more than that, if we want parents involved, we want to have parents who are going to be able to have the time to be involved.
We'll talk a little bit more about that as we look at childhood in America. Do we as a society practice what we preach when it comes to the social welfare of our children? Our guests today are parents and professionals Mike Munger, John McCann, and Beth Posner. Just ahead, more of your calls at 877-962-9862 on The State of Things. Stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. We're taking a look this hour at how we as a society and as individuals treat our children. We like to think we want to do the best, but there are ways that we live our lives and conduct our public policy that could suggest otherwise. With me in the studio today are three parents. Mike Munger is chair of the Political Science Department at Duke. John McCann is a columnist for the Durham Herald Sun. And Beth Posner is an attorney with Legal Aid of North Carolina. You are at your home and in your car, and you can give us a call at 877-962-9862 if you'd like to weigh in on the conversation. So now let's take a look at the pressures on parents. We've looked at what kids are going through and how we as a society kind of budget our resources. Parents, are we... And we talked a little bit about this in the beginning of the show, wanting the best for our kids, but having so many choices that that we're making decisions for our children that may not always be in our best interest. Are there too many? And here's the other question is whether or not, and we've seen this time and again, parents saying, how do I keep these cultural distractions away from my kids? There's so much on television, violence, sexuality, things I just don't want them to be exposed to. And how do I, as a parent, keep them from this if that's what I want to do? These are the pressures parents face. Beth?
Fortunately, my children are young enough that I haven't had to cross the bridge yet.
It's only going to get worse.
I know. of the media, although it's creeping in. I can't tell you how much my kids want Barbie dolls right now. but, the real parental pressure that I think we all face is having time with our children. And we have not as a society figured out how to work parental time into our day-to-day life, and working parents in particular is what I'm talking about. And so instead of putting pressure on the workplace to understand that they're part of a larger family system as well, and these things are interconnected, and that people need to have time away from their work, not just when their child's sick and not just when they've just had a baby, but when there are important events at school. And I don't just mean, parent-teacher conferences. I mean to be there for your children. Until the workplace understands about that, we're going to feel that pressure above all other pressures, and everyone is. And again, particularly low-wage workers who make an hourly wage and so have to think about that significantly. That's the largest pressure that I think we all universally feel. And the answer to that, lays in the factories and the big businesses to take a leadership position on that and say that, our society values children. Our society values children, maybe because they're going to be our future workers, maybe just because it is a higher good, and so we're going to have parental involvement leave time.
Are you talking about more flex time and this sort
flex
of thing
time,
in the workplace?
In the workplace, and I mean, I used to work for the state, and I believe I had some kind of parental involvement leave time. Maybe it was one day a month, but that was the state taking kind of a leadership position that probably other businesses, other corporations like, you know, McDonald's and Wendy's, places like that where my clients work, should, you know, follow that lead and think very seriously about that, you know, taking care of that pressure.
It does seem that more businesses, enlightened businesses anyway, are coming to this. They're realizing that if you want to keep good employees, you need to be flexible. And there does seem to be at least a trend in that direction. But Mike Munger, I wonder, well, first you can certainly comment on that, but this whole question of time, talk to us about that, parents and the amount of time we have today.
Most programs, to the extent that they exist, help those that are probably least in need of help. The McDonald's or the Walmart doesn't have a program like that. So the person who's working because they're right at the edge economically isn't going to be able to benefit from any of those. Now, clearly, for middle-class people, yes, that's a benefit, and it does give you more choices. Art Buchwald famously said, a columnist for the Washington Post, that the problem with prisons was we needed a better class of prisoner. If we had prisoners that weren't quite so violent, then things wouldn't be so bad. The problem with schools is we need better parents. And the paradox is that education is how people get better. It's how they get out of poverty. It's how they have hope for the future. And parents are willing to sacrifice if they think their children have that hope for the future, if they're going to live a life that's better than the one that they've had to live. So the trap is parents don't have enough time because they're trying to provide the resources to get their children out, and the children may not read. They may not have the experiences at home that make them able to excel.
And it's important, isn't it, to track this sea change in our economy, I think, to some extent. Don't you think, Mike? It's one thing to say the workplace should adjust, if it can, to give parents more time. The fact is, two parents have to work more often today than they did several decades ago to enjoy the same standard of living. Is it our economy itself that in some ways works against good parenting and works against the best interest of our children?
Well, it's a trap. We're undervaluing the service of people, usually women, that work inside the home raising children. If you're working a minimum wage job, you actually can't afford to pay daycare. There's two ways out of that. One is to provide good, high-quality, reliable daycare. We worry about welfare. We worry about parents not taking responsibility. But something that we could easily do to help families is provide better services in the form of reliable daycare and transportation to and from daycare. That would free people up to do other things.
John McCann, how do you feel about this business about parents and time and where this time has gone? Again, as I say, we're earning a lot of money, second, largest per capita income. The money's coming in, and yet we don't seem to have enough time because we're working too much. What's going on?
Well, see, what we need to do is reexamine this standard of living that we're talking about. You know, it's one thing to have, you know, a nice little house, decent car, but the problem comes in when we want to have, you know, the car. I don't want to name any particular car to offend anybody, or live in a certain neighborhood. I think we need to reexamine our priorities as far as that goes. And see, and that's when the parents, you know, come into play, because the kid doesn't care if he's riding in, you know, my little Honda Civic or, you know, somebody else's very fine car, you know.
Well, maybe your kid doesn't, but I tell you what, mine sure did.
But see, I think once we understand that, then you say, well, man, the reason I'm working so hard is because I want to have a house like Mr. Stachel, Mr. Munger, or Ms. Posner. You know, once I get rid of all that, the whole keeping up with the Joneses. See, that, I mean, it's cliche. It's nothing that you've never heard before. But, you know, it all goes back to that. You know, if I just simply live simply, a lot of things kind of correct themselves.
All right, let's go to Raleigh. Kevin is on the line. Hello, Kevin.
Kevin. Yeah, I just wanted to kind of add to this. I'm a parent of three children, and in my circle, I see parents who make, you know, work long hours. You know, I work long hours. You know, my wife works, but we've made personal sacrifices in our own self-interest. You know, in our own, you know, decisions that we might do personally for ourselves, whether that's, you know, we're going to sit down and watch a TV show, to invest that time in our after school or in the evening with the children when we study. Yet I see my peers not do the same thing, you know, and they are relying heavily and then complain heavily on the school system and what's lacking and what the kids aren't getting from the school. Yet, you know, we may spend, you know, anywhere from an hour to 4 hours a night, depending on, you know, what the load is between the three, you know, to invest that time to make sure that we were bettering our children. And I would have to think that a large portion, or at least a portion, not all, of parents don't make that same self-sacrifice as far as an investment in their children.
All right, Kevin, thank you very much. I guess it raises the question about whether we're earning, you know, we say we're making all this money to send our kids to good schools for them, but are we really? Is this really a selfish act? Is it really, and it would, is our children's success in a way a badge of our success if keeping up with the Joneses is the problem?
It is very selfish because, you know, I can say, hey, I want to move into a bigger house because we're expecting another child. But man, come on, how many people across this country, you know, live, you know, what we would call in cramped situations? You know, my point is we could make do with a lot less.
As sociologist Amitai Etzioni, along the lines of what you were saying, Mike Munger, has said that in the early 1970s, since then, the parenting industry has lost most of its workforce. Do we not value enough the occupation, the profession of parenting? Mm. And this gets into a difficult and serious question about feminism, for instance. You're not going to blame that for the dissolution of the family on this program, but you'll talk about whether or not in the process of valuing women in the workplace and allowing women a choice, we have inadvertently denigrated the profession of parenting.
Wow. No. I really think that there is a very unfortunate tension that the media plays attention to between parenting, or really motherhood is what they're talking about, and work. And I think that the focus on that is, in fact, indicative of an age-old and large kind of cultural desire to prevent women from entering in and staying in the workplace. And it really has very little to do with children and with what we want is best for that, you know, what the best that we want for our children. I find that this focus on the wars between women who work and women who don't work, if women could sit back and look at who's perpetuating the myth of these wars, you would see that this is yet again kind of another patriarchal structure to keep women from coming together to find reasonable solutions with each other. And so if there's anything that is, you know, that we can have, I think, appropriate nostalgia for in those good old days when, you know, there were fewer women in the workplace, it's that women worked together and helped each other, and that the community helped each other out. And there's no reason why that shouldn't still exist when we have dual, you know, working families. People should be helping each other out, and the focus then is back on the children and the best interest of the children and what we want for our communities. And so, you know, I know that's a very long-winded way of getting to what you're saying.
No, but you started with no.
No.
That's
the answer to my
And John
question.
McCann.
So I want to make sure I understand your point, Ms. Posner. Are you saying that it's bad for women to kind of to get out of the workplace? It's bad for women to stay at home?
I am not saying that at all. Okay. No. I think that this argument is so focused on individual choices, mm-hmm. and individual women's choices, and mostly women who have the means to choose, mm-hmm. really detracts, and I think is a deflection, and I would say sometimes a purposeful deflection by policymakers, away from children and away from a larger societal responsibility to take care of children, and instead to put it off on the individual choices of parents.
Mm. Sure.
Can I jump back on my soapbox for a minute?
Hop up.
All right, I'm back. Now, I would contend that society would be better off if we had more stay-at-home moms. Now, that being said, my wife does work, and we had the debate, we had the argument, she does work now. But when you talk about some families not being able to afford that, it gets back to my point about let's re-examining the standard of living. Does the other spouse, does the wife have to work, or does she have to work to get X, Y, and Z?
Well, let me ask you just to clarify that. Do you really mean stay-at-home moms, or do you mean a stay-at-home parent?
Am I still in my soapbox?
You're there.
It means a stay-at-home mom.
I would say stay-at-home mom.
Okay.
Again, not to be mm-hmm. chauvinistic, but I think there are certain roles that we'd be good to get back to.
Well, we're going to let you have that thought, but I want to pursue this other idea: whether or not if there are those who would agree that women have a place in the workplace, that professions for women is perfectly acceptable and desirable, still in the process of the debate and through the transition, was something lost? Was there an inadvertent dismissal, denigration of the value of the homemaker. Mike Munger, and I don't mean that this was intentional, and but could it have happened? Could we have in the process said, if we didn't like that and we had to fight to get into the workplace, then that must mean what we left wasn't quite as good, almost by extension.
Well, I think there are some facts are worth saying. If you, male or female, if you, your choice is to stay at home or to work at a job that pays $8 an hour, you're losing maybe $6,000, $8,000, $10,000 a year because you're putting your kids in daycare with after-tax dollars. So you work, you get money, and you pay taxes on it. You take those after-tax dollars, and then you pay for daycare. You're losing quite a bit when you control for the difference in quality that you could provide if you were there. But Beth's point is an important one. Why is it that we're talking about women that have no other opportunities, that systematically don't have professions? There's a difference between a job and a profession. And as a professional, then it does make sense to be able to get high-quality daycare. So we're posing a false dichotomy for women, which is work at a minimum wage job or stay home and provide care for the children. So I think probably more women do work out of the home than makes sense economically, given how much they can earn. But that says more about the lack of choices that we have about daycare than it does about them making wrong choices.
And those women for whom it's not economically, you know, it doesn't make economic sense to work, those women need to work, though, because they don't have another breadwinner in the home very often, and they don't have government money that they used to have helping them, and they get very minimal amount of food stamps. They have to find some kind of way. And again, we don't have quality child care for them. We don't have universal preschool for them.
So should it be industry, if we agree that there need to be more services, if women are going to be in the workplace, if there are going to be two wage earners in the workplace, is it up to industry to provide this, or is this, again, a place where government needs to step in?
That's a good idea. I mean, are you saying that part of my job package, part of my salary package is daycare? Not a bad idea at all.
Well, except that most jobs don't provide it. Now we start at kindergarten or first grade that the state provides it, and we could move back to age two or age one.
Beth, I mean, and the other question, of course, is they're not providing it because there's no competitive reason to provide
right.
it. If they had to and the other companies were, they would. Mm-hmm. But they can tell you if you would demand it that they can ship your job overseas.
They could. I mean, those kinds of jobs aren't even providing health benefits for their employees. So it's a hard world to imagine, one that we would hope for. But
right, time for one more call. Let's go to Susan in Durham. Susan?
Hi. I just wanted to comment that one solution, and I know it's only one solution because as you've been talking, it's very complicated, but it seems like it would be nice to have more opportunities to work part-time. I am a stay-at-home mom right now, and it's pretty darn draining. And I have friends who actually say, it's almost a relief to go to work. In some ways, it's easier. It's just different is what it is.
All right.
As a person who likes to have a balanced life, it would be nice to have opportunities to work and to be home. I have a cousin who spent a year trying to get her position split so that she could work part-time. And she ultimately succeeded, but it was she works for a big company, and it was a big bureaucratic thing because her boss didn't want her to, he didn't want to lose half of her position.
Right. Well, Susan, I am out of time, but I want to thank you for your call, and if I had time for a response, I'd ask it, but you'd get back up in your soapbox, John, and that'd be it. Thank you very much. Don McCann, columnist for the Durham Herald Sun, thanks for being with us.
Quite flying.
Mike Munger, chair of the Political Science Department at Duke, thank you.
Pleasure.
And Beth Posner, an attorney and with Legal Aid North Carolina, as well as a professor, visiting professor at UNC Law School, thanks for being with
thank
us.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the program. You can send us an email at sot@wunc.org. This is North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.